On the show today, the Ukraine Recovery Conference enters its second day in London.
I'm convinced that we need to further link Ukraine's recovery and the EU accession process. Our goal is to help rebuild a Ukraine that is fit for EU.
Plus, the Greek government is facing pressure to investigate the sinking of a migrant ship that left dozens dead and hundreds still missing.
Greece's deadliest migrant shipwreck in years has sparked accusations that the authorities did not do enough to help.
And later, a look at giraffes in Kenya and part two of our series exploring the Uyghurs and their treatment by the Beijing government. Today is Thursday, June 22nd. This is VOA's International Edition. From VOA headquarters in Washington, I'm Steve Karish. The Ukraine Recovery Conference began Wednesday in London. Ukraine and Britain are co-hosting the two-day conference. It brings together leaders from 60 nations as well as officials from the private sector. British Prime Minister Rishi Sunak announced $3 billion in World Bank loan guarantees as part of a new financial support package for Ukraine that will help support public services.
This is a vibrant, dynamic, creative European country that refuses to be subdued. So together with our allies, we will maintain our support for Ukraine's defense and for the counteroffensive. We will stand with Ukraine for as long as it takes for them to continue and to win this war.
Secretary of State Antony Blinken announced the U.S. will provide Ukraine with $1.3 billion in additional aid, but he added that investing in recovery isn't enough.
But make no mistake, all of these reforms and recovery efforts depend on Ukraine having the capacity to deter and defend against future attacks by Russia. That's why, even as we invest in Ukraine's immediate and long-term recovery, we also have to build a Ukrainian military that is strong enough to protect Ukraine's sovereignty, its territorial integrity, and its independence. Not just to defend Ukraine's land, but to defend all that Ukrainians are building and will build on that land. Even as we come together here in London, committed to supporting Ukraine's buildup, Russia continues to try to burn it down. So, let's be clear. Russia is causing Ukraine's destruction, and Russia will eventually bear the cost of Ukraine's reconstruction.
As for Ukraine's political future, German Foreign Minister Annalena Baerbock said it belongs in the EU.
I'm convinced that we need to further link Ukraine's recovery and the EU accession process. Our goal is to help rebuild a Ukraine that is fit for EU. We stand ready to support Ukraine in its reform efforts on the path towards membership. That's why Ukraine's accession process will have a special place at next year's recovery conference to be held in Germany to make recovery a truly European endeavor.
Baerbock also said Germany committed an extra $418 million for humanitarian assistance, and French Foreign Minister Catherine Colonna said France would provide an additional $44 million to fund emergency reconstruction of critical infrastructure and health equipment. While the politicians and financiers are in London, soldiers remain on the battlefield in Ukraine. Kyiv is about 2 weeks into a major push to retake areas occupied by Russia for more than a year. VOA's Heather Murdoch reports from the edges of the combat zone, where soldiers and locals say the fighting is brutal and slow against an enemy that is heavily fortified for battle.
On the edge of one part of Ukraine's 1,000-kilometer-long front line, medics prepare for injured soldiers to be rushed in from battle. They say the fighting in this area is different from other major Ukrainian pushes to retake areas occupied by Russia.
For example, they say they're seeing more bullet wounds because the fighting here is closer than in previous battles where most injuries came from bombings.
Ukraine has retaken several villages in the past 2 weeks, but soldiers say the movement is slow because Russians have occupied much of this area for at least a year. They have had time to build strong fortifications and get to know the region. but locals in the villages near the front line say they are starting to feel some relief as bombings get further and further away.
Some locals tell us that they expect this part of the war may go on a long time because, as they say, they are now fighting not kilometer by kilometer, but meter by meter. Reporting from Komar in eastern Ukraine, Heather Murdoch, VOA News.
Greece is under growing pressure to launch an investigation into the June 13th sinking of a vessel that was carrying up to 750 migrants. At least 82 people are known to have died, and hundreds more are still missing, including many women and children. Most were from Egypt, Syria, and Pakistan. Henry Ridgewell reports.
In the port of Piraeus Sunday, hundreds of protesters marched on the headquarters of the Greek Coast Guard and the European Union's border agency Frontex, holding aloft banners that said murderers. Greece's deadliest migrant shipwreck in years has sparked accusations that the authorities did not do enough to help. The boat set sail from Libya with up to 750 people on board. The Greek Coast Guard said at first that the boat was on a steady course towards Italy, so it did not intervene. It later said it tried to aid the migrant boat by attaching a rope, but claimed the migrants untied it. Footage was taken from a ship that had diverted to help the migrants later on June 13th. The crew offered water and food. The migrant boat appears to restart its engine. The vessel sank later that night in Greek waters. Many survivors say the boat had lost power for several hours before it sank. The United Nations has called for an investigation, a demand echoed by human rights groups, who say survivors' testimonies contradict the Coast Guard's version of events. Kondylia Gogou is from Amnesty International.
We think that this really essential that a prompt, thorough and independent investigation and effective takes place.
Greece continues to insist that the migrants did not ask for help and were not in danger until the boat sank. Greek police have arrested 9 suspects, all Egyptian nationals who were believed to be on the boat. Critics say Europe's migration policy is also to blame. Again, Amnesty's Kondylia Gogou.
As long as we don't have sufficient policies in the EU for safe and legal routes, this kind of dangerous journeys will continue.
Survivors were taken to this migrant camp on the mainland. Amid the grief, there have been occasional moments of joy as survivors are reunited with loved ones. But hundreds of people are missing, presumed dead. Their loved ones are demanding truth and justice. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
And here are some more of the stories we're following from around the world. A Chinese aircraft carrier group sailed through the sensitive Taiwan Strait on Wednesday. India said it will give a naval warship to Vietnam in the latest signal of tightening defense ties between the two countries. The U.S. Coast Guard says a Canadian aircraft has detected underwater noises during the search for a submersible that vanished while taking tourists to see the wreckage of the Titanic. And a strong explosion rocked a building in Paris's left bank on Wednesday, injuring at least 24 people. Police are investigating suspicions that a gas leak caused the blast. This is VOA News.
VOA Science Beat. A report from a Nepal-based research organization finds that water security for nearly 2 billion people downstream from the Hindu Kush Himalayan ranges will likely be threatened this century if global warming is not controlled. Earlier reports have found that the cryosphere are among the worst affected by climate change. The study by the International Center for Integrated Mountain Development found that Himalayan glaciers disappeared 65% faster in the 2010s than in the previous decade. It also found the glaciers could lose up to 80% of their volume by the end of this century. Ice and snow in the Hindu Kush Himalayans are an important source of water for 12 rivers that flow through 16 countries in Asia, providing fresh water to 240 million people in the mountains and another 1.65 billion downstream. I'm VOA's Steve Miller.
It's VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Karish. It's part two of our series on the Uyghur community of Western China in a few minutes. First, though, the Druze Arabs are a small ethnic and religious minority, primarily living in southern Syria and Lebanon and northern Israel. On Wednesday, hundreds of men from Druze Arab villages in the Golan Heights protested against Israeli plans to set up a wind farm, some clashing with riot police in an unusually violent confrontation that injured several people. Reuters' Olivia Chan has more.
Druze Arabs on the occupied Golan Heights clashed with Israeli riot police on Wednesday. Several were injured in the unusually violent confrontation. Hundreds of men were protesting against Israeli plans to set up a wind farm. Video distributed by Israeli police showed stones being thrown at police water cannon. Another video shows tear gas being fired towards Druze protesters. Israel captured the Golan from Syria in a 1967 war. It has generally placid relations with the strategic plateau's Druze community. Many of them profess loyalty to Damascus. Some Druze have complained of bureaucratic neglect by Israel, whose proceeding with the erection of several wind turbines is viewed by the Golan villagers as an encroachment.
That's Olivia Chan from Reuters reporting. Weeks after the discovery of a mass grave in Kenya on land owned by cult leader Pastor Paul McKenzie, some families are still searching for news about their loved ones. One family has been relying on accounts and clues from survivors to try to piece together the whereabouts of their lost brother. Saida Swale met his family in Mombasa and has this report.
Hakuna Mungu kama wewe.
At the home of James Tole Mombela, the family says a prayer for their brother Nelson Mombela. It has been months since they saw him. His brother James Mombela says his disappearance came after Nelson stopped taking his kids to school and began behaving oddly. The brother said people assumed but didn't know Mackenzie's teachings at that time. He said his brother kept saying that the world is ending and Jesus is coming back. However, his family differed with him, the brother added. Nelson Kimbichi Mombela quit his job and secretly moved his wife and six children to the Shakahola farm owned by Pastor Paul Mackenzie. The religious cult leader was arrested in early May, accused of ordering his followers to starve themselves and their children to gain salvation. When mass graves were discovered in Shakahola, James made his way there to search for his brother, sister-in-law, and their six children. What he learned was shocking. He says one of the survivors told him about his niece Janet and his brother called Sylvester, later baptized to be called Paul. The person told him that he lived close to Pastor Paul Mackenzie and that the six children, including their mother, had died. Investigators are still trying to determine how many people lost their lives following the cult-like sect. So far, they have uncovered more than 300 bodies. They also found personal belongings, including this Bible belonging to Mr. and Mrs. Nelson Kimbichi Mombela. Nelson's mother says she misses her son. She says he was a good boy. He was quiet and very soft-spoken. The number of missing people is still far greater than the bodies recovered, according to Hassan Musa of the Kenya Red Cross.
As Kenya Red Cross, we've registered 618 missing people. These are people reported by their family members that in one way or the other, they're either in Shakahola Forest or at the Malindi Sub-County Morgue.
The family said they gave DNA samples to investigators in the hopes it could help them identify the bodies of Nelson and his family. Saida Swale for VOA News, Mombasa, Kenya.
And staying in Kenya, giraffes are an endangered species. And in Kenya, the population of the world's tallest animals is on the decline. Officials say as many as 4 to 5 giraffes are being killed per day because of relentless poaching for meat and the harsh realities of climate change. Ahmed Hussein reports from Wajir County in Kenya.
At Sabuli Wildlife Conservancy in Kenya's Wajir County, a group of reticulated giraffes, also known as Somali giraffes, gather. Conservationists say the rare Somali giraffe found mainly in northern Kenya is trending toward extinction. They say there is a need to support community-led conservation efforts to ensure the survival of this threatened species. Sharmake Mohammed is a conservationist and the co-founder of Northeastern Conservancies Association, or NECA. He spoke to VOA in an interview.
It is going under very, very loud extinction because there is highly, you know, giraffe at this moment is facing many threats. The biggest being poaching, commercialized poaching in Wajir County and beyond. It's also facing the effects of climate change, severe drought. You know, we have prolonged droughts that have been happening here over the last few years. We're lucky we have rains now. We've just had very good rains. And the recovery now of those giraffes are threatened by the poaching that is happening.
This year, Kenya is celebrating its annual Wild Giraffe Day in Habaswein town. Conservationists and government officials have gathered here to educate the public on the importance of protecting wildlife. KWS Deputy Warden Sharif Ahmed.
We are creating awareness and sensitizing the community around our Wajir on the relations and coexistence with the giraffes and other any other wild animals that might be around and how they can benefit.
Images of the Somali giraffe alongside the camel make up the coat of arms emblem for Wajir County government. The giraffe in particular has historical and cultural significance, says Khalif Abdi Hirbate, the Wajir County Executive Committee member for Tourism and Wildlife.
It's our culture, it's our heritage, and we wish to protect it. We wish to protect it in many ways. Our people are very conscious. This wild giraffe is to emphasize the need for us to protect these animals.
According to the Giraffe Conservation Foundation, giraffe numbers have plummeted by around 30% since the 1980s, and only 117,000 giraffes remain in the world. Conservationists like Sharmake remain hopeful that rural communities in Kenya will heed the call to protect the giraffe and other wildlife. Ahmed Hussein for VOA News, Wajir, Kenya.
A deadly protest in her home city and the jailing of her brother has prompted Zubaria Shamsuddin to devote her career to publicizing the severe human rights abuses against Uyghurs in the Xinjiang region and the systematic oppression that China denies is taking place. VOA's Elizabeth Lee has the story.
Zubaira Shamsuddin can never return to her homeland.
If I was in China, I don't think I would be alive.
As a Uyghur living in the U.S., Shamsuddin is devoted to fighting against what she and many other organizations worldwide say are injustices against Uyghurs in China, especially in the Xinjiang region. As Chinese outreach coordinator for the group Uyghur Human Rights Project, she tries to educate Mandarin speakers about what is happening there.
Uyghurs either detained in the concentration camps or detained in the slave labor Chinese factories.
A 2022 United Nations report found China responsible for serious human rights violations. The U.S. and other Western countries have accused China of actions akin to genocide in Xinjiang. In response to VOA's inquiry, the Chinese embassy in Washington sent links to statements by officials about Beijing's policy in the region. Cui Tiankai was the Chinese ambassador to the U.S.
The Uyghur population in Xinjiang has more than doubled in the past four decades. Where did the genocide come from? Forced labor is also nonsense. Workers in Xinjiang choose occupations entirely according to their own wishes.
Chinese officials say its policies in Xinjiang have helped suppress terrorism. Shamsuddin says members of her own family have experienced violence under China's Xinjiang policy. In 1997, in the city that Uyghurs call Gulja, a protest calling for equal treatment turned deadly.
It's kind of turning point in my life. In 1997, the Gulja massacre happened, which is my hometown. And many of my family members became direct victims of that massacre. One of my brother, he's still in prison as a political prisoner because of his connection with Gulja protests.
Shamsuddin decided to switch her career from computers to law and international relations, which led her to activist work in the U.S.
China sees what happened in 1997 differently, as shown in the state media report that uses the city's Chinese name, Yining.
Among some of the worst incidents, the 1997 Yining terror attack, which left 7 dead and 198 wounded.
Beijing also says Xinjiang is benefiting from its counter-terrorism efforts.
This is a land of harmony and stability, where people from various ethnic backgrounds live and work in peace and contentment.
Fergus Chiel is part of the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists.
There are Uyghurs all around the world that are can tell you that they are not living a safe, happy, and fulfilling life, despite what Beijing says.
Shamsuddin says even those who are not in prison are still not free and live under digital and physical surveillance.
We will just have no space to breathe.
Because of her work, Shamsuddin says her relatives in China are under surveillance and travel and communications restrictions. But it is her connection to that repression, she says, that compels her to fight for the rights of Uyghurs. Elizabeth Lee, VOA News, Washington.
And that'll wrap it up for today. This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thanks for listening. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, visit us online at voanews.com and follow VOA News on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. Until next time, I'm Steve Karish in Washington. Stay safe and have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
President Joe Biden has called the United States' relationship with India the defining relationship of the 21st century. The road that we've traveled over the last 25 years has been quite extraordinary, declared Secretary of State Antony Blinken at the U.S.-India Business Council's India Ideas Summit.
Simply put, we see this defining relationship as a unique connection between the world's oldest and largest democracies, with a special obligation now to demonstrate that our governments can deliver for and empower all of our citizens.
We see the importance of the partnership in a shared commitment to address regional and global challenges, said Secretary Blinken. But at the heart of the strategic relationship between our countries are economic ties.
Last year, as you all know, trade between our nations reached a record $191 billion, making the United States the largest trading partner for India. American companies have now invested at least $54 billion in India, from manufacturing to telecommunications. In the United States, Indian companies have invested over $40 billion in IT and pharmaceuticals and more, supporting 425,000 jobs from California to Georgia.
India has also joined three pillars of the Indo-Pacific Economic Framework, committing to build more resilient supply chains, to seize clean energy opportunities, and to combat corruption. The U.S. and India are elevating and expanding their strategic technology partnership on all levels because both nations believe technology use should be informed by democratic values and respect for human rights. Central to all of this cooperation is diversifying and deepening supply chains with trusted countries, while also reducing strategic dependencies. Finally, the U.S. and India are investing in their people, said Secretary Blinken.
U.S. and India's education systems have produced the leaders of some of our most iconic companies. Indian Americans have created a third of all immigrant-funded startups in the United States. And maybe most significant for the future of ties between our countries, we have more than 200,000 Indians studying in American universities, making India the second largest source of international students in the United States.
The United States and India will continue to work together to advance transparency, promote market access, and strengthen their democracies in order to unleash the full potential of their people.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.